理课堂听 class.com
2001 Grade 8 Paper 1 Part 1 Listening Comprehension In sections A, B, and C, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Section A, Talk. Questions 1 to 5 refer to the talk in this section. At the end of the talk, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now listen to the talk. The World Bank is one of the major channels through which development aid is passed from the industrial West to the poor and developing nations of the world. Its scale of operations is vast, which is why its lending program exceeds $7 billion a year and its workforce numbers about 4,500. In the last decade, important changes have taken place in the size of the bank's operations and in its emphasis of the lending policies. What immediately strikes anyone looking at the lending figures over the past 10 years is the tremendous expansion in the bank's loan program. This has increased from $1 billion to nearly $7 billion. The figure includes hard loans, which are made at current rates of interest, and soft loans, allocated to poor countries at concessionary rates. Policy, the bank has had affiliate, the international development explosion, which is occurring in many. Hiding the emphasis of its lending policy, it is a fact that the fertility rate of poor countries is often very high. This is one of the main reasons for these countries remaining poor. Unfortunately, wide-ranging corruption programs do not usually reduce this rate because there is a strong and deeply rooted tradition among people in these countries to have big families. What the bank discovered was that there was a link between economic and social development on the one hand and reduction of fertility rate on the other. Thus, by improving basic health service, by introducing better nutrition, by increasing literacy, and by promoting more even income distribution in a poor country, a lower and more acceptable fertility rate could be. This advance in thinking persuaded the bank to change its overall lending strategy. While previously it had concentrated on the big infrastructure projects, such as dams, roads, and bridges, it began to switch to projects which directly improved the basic services of a country. There was a shift, if you like, from building dams to digging water holes to provide clean water. A second reason for the changes in the approach was that the bank had learned a bitter lesson from the project finance. Many capital investments have scarcely touched the lives of the urban and rural poor, nor had they created employment. The projects did not have the trickle-down effect they had in industrialized countries. Instead, the huge dams, steel mills, and so on were left as monuments to themselves. This redirection of its lending has meant that the bank has tended to support labor-intensive activities rather than capital-intensive ones, both in rural and urban areas. There is a better chance in the first case that its funds will benefit the bottom 40% of a country's population. The bank is also looking at ways of stimulating the growth of small businesses in many developing countries, since this would create employment opportunities for people with low incomes. Being such a big and obvious target, the bank has often come under fire. For example, its officials have been taken to task for using the Concorde supersonic aircraft so frequently, about 500 times in 1 year. Also, the large growth in the organization's personnel has not pleased some critics. A more substantial criticism has concerned the bank's policy of setting annual targets for lending to specified countries. This could lead to a deterioration in the quality of loans, some say. One former bank official has said, rather than encourage growth for its own sake, the bank should begin to think of itself less as a foreign aid agency and more of a financial dealmaker combining official with private resources for its specific purposes. Finally, some people maintain that the impact of the projects funded by the bank has been modest. When one looks around the world at regions or countries that have successfully transformed to industrial status, it seems that one should beware of overestimating the bank's impact. Take Hong Kong as an example. Its changes have come about as a result of a trade offensive. The purpose has been to flood Western markets with low-priced goods made by capitalist methods of production. The example seems to indicate that some regions can prosper without the bank's aid as well.
Section B, Conversation. Questions 6 to 10 are based on a conversation. At the end of the conversation, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following questions. Now, listen to the conversation.
Well, it seems quite common, actually. Lots of people in Australia are now traveling and taking time off. And when I was traveling, I met so many people doing the same thing.
Yeah. So where did you start off?
Well, I went to New Zealand first. And I got a job in a computer company as a secretary, and I worked there for 4 months.
Really? You can do that, can you? I mean, it's possible for anyone to get a job in New Zealand without being a New Zealander?
No, not everybody. Only Australians and New Zealanders can exchange either. You know, you can work in either country.
Oh, right, yeah.
So that was easy. I worked there for 4 months and raised enough money for the rest of the travels, really. So, from there, I went to Indonesia and traveled around the different islands of Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Thailand, China, Nepal, and India.
What about in Indonesia? What did you do? Did you fly mostly between the islands?
I did a bit of that, and boats. Mainly local boats between the islands.
What about Singapore? People say it's very, very modern, but because it's too modern, it's rather boring. Did you find that?
Well, it's difficult to say, really. It has different attractions, you know. The Chinese, Malay, and Hindu communities are there. It has its own culture and custom, very different from the others, and it's a great big shopping center, and I really enjoyed it from that point of view. And it was very clean.
And after that, you said you went Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, and then China? Well, that's a great country to travel in, isn't it?
Well, it was. Yeah, it was fabulous. It really was. You haven't been there, then?
No, I haven't. I mean, it's very big, isn't it? Did you...
Yeah, I only had 1 month traveling in China. That was too short for such a vast country as China. I thought I didn't have enough time, so I sacrificed a lot of places and did the main tours round, really. I went to Beijing, the capital, Kaifeng, Yinchuan, and Tibet.
Wow, how exciting. You said after Beijing you went to...
That was Kaifeng, in central China's Hunan province. It's a charming city and has got a lot to look around, like temples and pagodas, very traditional.
Mm-hmm.
What fascinated me when I was there was that some Jews went to live in Kaifeng many years ago. As early as the 16th century, there were Jewish families there. They had their Saint Guide and the five books of Masuzas. Even today, several hundred descendants of the original Jews still live in Kaifeng.
Really? I've never heard of that. And where did you go after Kaifeng?
I went northwest to Yinchuan, the provincial city of Ningxia Hui Autonomous Region.
Is this the place where there's always been a shortage of water?
No. On the contrary, it has got an abundant supply of water because it's near the Yellow River. In this sense, Yinchuan has a favorable geographical position in otherwise harsh surroundings.
But what did you see there, then?
Ningxia was once the capital of the Western Xia during the 11th century. So outside Yinchuan, you can still see the Western Xia Mausoleum, where the kings of the kingdom are buried. The tombs are pretty scattered in a big area at the foot of the Hulan Mountain. And inside the city, there's a famous mosque in the architectural style of the Middle East. It's really a place worth visiting. You get to know something about Chinese Muslims.
That sounds really interesting. Where did you travel after that?
I was lucky enough to get into Tibet, and that was brilliant.
Yeah? What was the most interesting place you visited, do you think?
Well, I think actually Tibet was the most fascinating and exciting. I've never been anywhere so different. The people there are wonderful. The clothes they wear, the food they eat.
And you said you went to Nepal as well.
Yeah, that was sort of an easier version of Tibet, really. There are a lot of Tibetans there, as well as other tribes and Nepalese. So that was good, because I went trekking in Nepal. You should do that.
How long did you trek for?
Oh, I only did a short one, only for a week. I was lazy.
Wasn't it very tiring?
No, it wasn't, actually. I mean, just say you are on a pace and don't push yourself too hard. That would be a stupid thing to do. You don't have to walk very far. So that was great.
So how did you feel after all this traveling? How did you feel to stop traveling? I mean, you're on the move alone for months and months, and suddenly you're here and not traveling anymore. How does it feel?
Oh, I was ready to stop anyway. You get pretty sick wearing the same clothes and washing them in different hotels. I never stay in the same place for longer than 2 days and things. I was ready to stop. I don't think I could keep doing it. I mean, that I've met people who have been traveling for 2 or 3 years. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe it's something I should try after this.
Well, I think you really should. Section C, News Broadcast. Questions 11 and 12 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news. Mike Tyson could sign a deal by Friday to face either Germany's Schultz or Denmark's Brian Nelson here on August 21st in the heavyweight first fight since his release from jail. The former Wood heavyweight champion was released on Monday after 4 months behind bars for assault from the wake of a traffic accident last August. His deal with Showtime makes August come back lightly. August 21st is certainly a day we are looking at, Showtime's boxing director Jim Larkin said. Hopefully in the next few days, we'll have something concrete. Nevada boxing officials revoked Tyson's license for more than a year after he bit Evander Holyfield's ear in June 1997. But they planned no action on Tyson because the license they granted him to fight does not expire until the end of the year. That came before the assault charges have been heard and with a victim's support.
Question 13 is based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 15 seconds to answer the question. Now, listen to the news. The United States has begun to review Russian documents about the life and death of former President John F. Kennedy and expected to release them once the review is complete, the White House said on Monday. The documents which Russia gave the United States on Sunday could be of particular interest because Kennedy's assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, lived in the former Soviet Union for several years before he returned to the United States and was arrested for killing the former president on November 22, 1963. Russian President Boris Yeltsin surprised U.S. President Bill Clinton on Sunday when he turned over what was described as the results of an exhaustive search of Russian government, military, and private archives for papers about Kennedy and his assassination.
Questions 14 and 15 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news. Hong Kong's unemployment rate has remained stable at 6.3% in the past 3 months, and business conditions have improved in the last month. Figures indicated that from March to May this year, the size of the labor force was provisionally at 3,462,000, while the number of unemployed people stood at 216,000. The number of cases of insolvency, sensational business, and retrenchment, and the number of workers affected by these cases, as recorded by the Labor Department, have shown a climbing trend in recent months. From March to May 1999, 78 such cases involving 3,882 workers were recorded as compared to 93 cases affecting 5,220 workers for the 3 months from December 1998 to February 1999. Figures for the period from March to May 1999, when compared with those from February to April 1999, show an increase in the unemployment rate, mainly in the renovation maintenance, wholesale and retail transport sectors, which have offset the decrease seen in the construction, import, and export and financing sectors.
Section D, Note-Taking and Gap-Filling. In this section, you will hear a mini-lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening to the lecture, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a 15-minute gap-filling task on the answer sheet after the mini-lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Now, listen to the mini-lecture. The press conference is an all-too-familiar phenomenon around us. However, when people start thinking about its advantages, it sometimes seems difficult to think of any that the press conference provides for the competent news reporters. Use of the press conference by public officials and private entrepreneurs helps give rise to the phrase swindle event, an event contrived to create news coverage where none had been considered wanted. However, having said that, one value of the news conference by a public official is the symbolic nature of the event. Perhaps this is reason enough to continue the practice. At a press conference, a public official supposedly submits to examination by responding to unsolicited and perhaps hostile questions. A related advantage to the reporter is that the press conference affords an opportunity to get the public official on record with regard to government policies. Statements from a press conference can serve as criteria against which subsequent statements and policies are measured. In that regard, press conference information may be used as reference points, more so than comments reported by a single news medium. Also, when there is a single issue, topic to address, such as a new government program, an earthquake, or the nomination of a new government minister, the press conference offers benefits of efficiency in that officials can speak to a number of reporters at once on an issue of public concern and interest. The press conference may be at its best in its almost one-way format. Now, let's move on to the disadvantages. Are there any serious ones? Generally speaking, the press conference format, as it stands, makes it difficult for the reporter to get worthwhile information. At the press conference, particularly a large one, the well-prepared reporter may never get to ask a question, and certainly it's unlikely to have a chance to ask a follow-up question. Another disadvantage in the press conference comes from the news source, that is, the news provider. The news source generally decides who asks questions, determines the length of the answers, and can avoid any follow-up questions and rephrase tough questions to his or her likings, and sets the time, place, and duration of the interview. Press conferences televised live to the news audience sometimes only highlight the disadvantages for the news reporters, since there is little or no time to challenge, clarify, or place in context material provided by the news source. Despite these disadvantages and others inherent in how reporters gather information, the news reporter can help assure worthwhile information from a news source he shared with the news audience. One way to reduce the likelihood of errors is to use multiple forms of interviewing, by telephone, in person, and at press conferences, as well as multiple sources. Common to the success of these approaches, however, are such interrelated ingredients as the preparation of the news reporter, the competence of the news source, and the nature of the questions asked. Let's look at the preparations first. The nature of much of news coverage requires the reporter to be well-read on contemporary events. Like other professionals and craftsmen, the reporter must keep up to date on journalistic subject matter, that is, the human condition. Although the subject is broad, it offers the advantage that there is little a reporter can read or witness that would not help in covering the news at one time or another. Next, being prepared for an interview includes giving some thought to the competence of the news source. The relationships between news reporters and news sources would benefit the news audience more if reporters would frequently ask themselves, what is this news source competent to talk about? What can this person tell the news audience that few others can't? Two words of caution regarding the issue of competence. First, the reporter should not take for granted that because of position or experience, the news source who should know does know and can provide information. Second, the competence of the news source needs to be linked with the news-gathering methods. Let's just spend a minute on the first point. There are generally four conditions under which the reporter should not give credence to a news source information. 1. The source may not know the information the reporter wants. 2. The source may have the information and want to share it, but may lack the verbal skills or the concepts to do so. 3. The source may have the desired information, but not want to share, or, worse, may lie to avoid sharing information. Last, the source may be willing to share the information, but unable to recall it. Now, in addition to preparation of the reporter and the competence of the news source, there is one more important ingredient in successful news coverage, that is, the nature of the questions asked. It is generally agreed the nature of the questions can shape the nature of the answer. General questions like, are you for market economy? May lead to a respondent saying virtually anything and still being rather vague. On the other hand, a too narrow question may limit the respondent to one particular answer only. In order to gather information from news sources as accurately as possible, reporters can improve the questions in the following five ways. Firstly, avoid words with double meanings. Secondly, avoid long questions. Thirdly, specify the time, place, and context you want the respondent to assume. And number 4, it's often helpful to ask questions in terms of the respondent's own immediate and recent experience, rather than in generalities. Finally, either make explicit all the alternatives the respondent should have in mind when answering the question, or make none of them explicit. Do not leave the news source by suggesting a desired answer and not mentioning other alternatives. Okay, to sum up, today's lecture has covered some of the advantages and disadvantages of the press conference and three important facets of successful news coverage. In our next lecture, we'll continue to discuss how to become a competent news reporter. Now, you have 2 minutes to check your notes, and then please complete the 15-minute map filling task on the answer sheet. This is the end of listening comprehension. Test for English Majors, 2002, Grade 8, Paper 1, Part 1, Listening Comprehension. In sections A, B, and C, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Section A, Talk. Questions 1 to 5 refer to the talk in this section. At the end of the talk, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now, listen to the talk.
The first era in American urban history extended from the early 17th century to about 1840. Throughout those years, the total urban population remained small, and so were the cities. At the first federal census in 1790, city dwellers made up nearly 5.1% of the total population, and only 2 places had more than 25,000 inhabitants. 50 years later, only 10. 8% of the nation's population fell into the urban category, and only one city, New York, contained more than 250,000 people. Largely because of the unsophisticated modes of transportation, even the more popular places in the early 19th century remained small enough that people easily walked from one end of the city to the other in those days. Though small by modern standards, these walking cities, as it were, performed a variety of functions in those days. One was economic. Throughout the pre-modern era, this part of the urban life remained so overwhelmingly commercial that almost every city owed its development to trade. Yet city dwellers concerned themselves not only with promoting agricultural activities in their rural areas, they also collected and processed goods from these areas and then distributed them to other cities. From the beginning then, and increasingly in the 18th and early 19th centuries, cities served as centers of both commerce and simple manufacturing. Apart from the economic functions, the early cities also had important non-economic functions to play. Since libraries, museums, schools, and colleges were built and needed people to go there to visit or to study, cities and the larger earlier towns, with their concentrations of population, tended to serve as centers of educational activities and the points from which information was spread to the countryside. In addition, the towns with people of different occupational, ethnic, racial, and religious affiliations became focuses of formal and informal organizations, which were set up to foster the security and to promote the interests and influence of each group. In these days, the pre-industrial city in America functioned as a complex and varied organizing element in American life, not as a simple, homogeneous, and static unit. The vitality of these early cities was reinforced by the nature of their location and by the process of town spreading. Throughout the pre-industrial period of American history, the cities occupied sites on the eastern portion of the then largely undeveloped continent, and the settlement of countryside generally followed the expansion of towns in that region. The various interest groups in each city tended to compete with their counterparts in other cities for economic, social, and political control, first of nearby and later of more distant and larger areas. And always there remained the undeveloped regions to be developed through the establishment of new towns by individuals and groups. These individuals and groups sought economic opportunities or looked for a better social, political, or religious atmosphere. In this sense, the city still helped the development of the successions of urban frontiers. Well, this kind of circumstance made Americans one of the most political and self-conscious city-building peoples of their time. It did not result in a steadily urbanizing society in the sense that decade by decade, an even larger proportion of population lived in cities. In 1690, an estimated 9 to 10% of American colonists lived in urban settlements. A century later, that is, the end of the 18th century, though 24 places had 2,500 persons or more, city dwellers accounted for only 5.1% of the total population. For the next 30 years, the proportion remained relatively stable, and it was not until 1830 that the urban figure moved back up to the level of 1690. In short, as the number of cities increased after 1690, they sent larger numbers of people into the countryside. Then they returned. Nonetheless, the continuous movement of people into and out of the cities made life in the many but relatively small places lively and stimulating.
Section B, Interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on an interview. At the end of the interview, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following five questions. Now, listen to the interview. I'm talking to Janet Toms, who has spent many years negotiating for several well-known national and multinational companies. Hello, Janet.
Hello.
Now, Janet, you've experienced and observed the negotiation strategies used by people from different countries and speakers of different languages. So before we come on to the differences, could I ask you to comment, first of all, on what such encounters have in common?
Okay, well, I'm just going to focus on the situations where people speak English in international business situations.
I see. Now, not everyone speaks English to the same degree of proficiency, so maybe that affects the situation.
Yes, perhaps, but that's not always so significant. Well, because, I mean, negotiations between business partners from different countries normally mean that we have negotiations between individuals who belong to distinct cultural traditions.
Oh, I see.
Well, every individual has a different way of performing various tasks in everyday life.
Yes, but isn't it the case that in the business negotiation they must come together and work together to a certain extent? I mean, doesn't that level out the style of differences somewhat?
Oh, I'm not so sure. I mean, there are people in the so-called Western world who say that in the course of the past 30 or 40 years, there are a lot of things that have changed a great deal globally. And then, as a consequence, national difference has diminished or got fewer, giving way to some sort of international Americanized style.
Ah, I heard that. Now, some people say this Americanized style has acted as a model for local patterns.
Maybe it has, maybe it hasn't. Because, on the one hand, there does appear to be a fairly unified, even uniform style of doing business, with certain basic principles and preferences, you know, like time is money, that sort of thing. But at the same time, it's very important to remember that we all retain aspects of the national characteristics. But it's actually behavior we're talking about here. We shouldn't be too quick to generalize that into national characteristics and stereotypes. It doesn't help much.
Yeah, you mentioned Americanized style. What's particular about this American style of business bargaining or negotiation?
Well, I've noticed that, for example, when Americans negotiate with people from Brazil, the American negotiators make their points in a direct, self-explanatory way.
I see.
Well, the Brazilians make their points in a more indirect way.
How?
Let me give you an example. Brazilian importers look at the people they are talking to straight in the eyes a lot. They spend time on what for some people seems to be background information. They seem to be more indirect.
Then what about the American negotiators?
An American style of negotiating, on the other hand, is far more like that of point making. First point, second point, third point, and so on. Now, of course, this isn't the only way in which one can negotiate. And there's absolutely no reason why this should be considered the best way to negotiate.
Right. Americans seem to have a different style, say, even from the British, don't they?
Exactly. Which just goes to show how careful you must be about generalizing. I mean, how else can you explain how American negotiators are seen as informal and sometimes much too open? For, in British eyes, Americans are direct, even blunt.
Is that so?
Yeah. And at the same time, for the British, too, German negotiators can appear direct and uncompromising in negotiations. And yet, if you experience Germans and Americans negotiating together, it's often the Americans who will be too blunt for German negotiators.
Fascinating. So people from different European countries use different styles, don't they?
That's right.
Okay, so what about the Japanese, then? I mean, is their style different from Americans and Europeans?
Oh, well, yes, of course. Many Europeans know the extreme politeness of their Japanese counterparts, the way they avoid giving the slightest offense, you know. They are also very reserved towards people they don't know well. At the first meetings, American colleagues have difficulties in finding the right approach sometimes. But then, when you meet the Japanese negotiators again, this initial impression turns to disappear. But it's perhaps true to say that your average Japanese business person does choose his or, more rarely, her words very carefully.
So can we say that whatever nationality you're dealing with, you need to remember that different nationalities negotiate in different ways?
Well, it's perhaps more helpful to bear in mind that different people behave and negotiate in different ways, and you shouldn't assume that everyone will behave in the same way you do.
Right. This is definitely a very useful tip for our businessmen who often negotiate with their overseas partners. Okay, Janet, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Section C, News Broadcast. Question 11 is based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 15 seconds to answer the question. Now listen to the news. The first International Tibetan Traditional Medicine Conference will be held July 15th through 17th in Lhasa, capital city of the Tibet Autonomous Region. China's Ethnic Medicine Institute, Tibetan Health Bureau, and Tibetan Medical College will co-host the conference. The conference has received more than 500 research papers from China and abroad. The organizing committee primarily selected 290 articles to be discussed at the conference. More than 50 foreign guests from the United States, Russia, Britain, India, Germany, France, Italy, and Nepal will attend the meeting. The Chinese mainland was sending a delegation consisting of 250 Tibetan medicine experts to the conference.
Questions 12 and 13 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the questions. Now, listen to the news. The government of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region will actively adopt information technology and build an e-government, a senior HK official said yesterday. This is an integral part of Hong Kong's Digital 21 strategy, formulated in 1998 to make Hong Kong both a regional and worldwide internet center, said Carrie Yao, Secretary for Information Technology and Broadcasting. She outlined three policy objectives in developing an e-government in Hong Kong at the IBM Asian Pacific E-Government Executive Seminar. The first policy objective is to develop an electronic and paperless government so as to improve the efficiency, cost-effectiveness, and quality of public services. The second is to promote the wider adoption of e-commerce, with the government setting a leading example. The third is, through the e-government program, to integrate service delivery across multiple departments and agencies.
Questions 14 and 15 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news. Canada's Olympic 100-meter champion, Donovan Bailey, showed he was on his way back to top form on Tuesday by winning the 100 meters at the athletic meet in Switzerland in a time of 9.98 seconds. Despite unfavorable wind conditions, Bailey recorded the second-best time of the year, short after 9.91, set by double world champion Morris Green of the United States on May 13th in Osaka, Japan. "I would have run 9.8 if I really pushed myself," said Bailey, 1996 Olympic and 1995 world champion. The Canadian has been fighting for form before the Sydney Olympics, following a long-term injury which resulted in a disappointing series of starless season.
Section D, Note-Taking and Gap-Filling. In this section, you will hear a mini-lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening to the lecture, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a 15-minute gap-filling task on the answer sheet after the mini-lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Now, listen to the mini-lecture. Study Activities in University. Good morning. Today, we'll look at some study activities carried out in the university. As we know, students in colleges or universities are expected to master some academic materials that are fairly difficult to understand. However, some of them find it hard to learn some complex, abstract, or unfamiliar subject matter. As a result, a central problem in higher education is how to internalize academic knowledge, that is, how to make knowledge your own. In order to do so, we must convert knowledge from being other people's knowledge to being part of your own ways of thinking. Then, how are we going to do it? And what are the means available to help us in the process of learning? There are four key study activities currently used in higher education to encourage students to internalize knowledge. They are the ones we are familiar with: writing essays, going to classes and seminars, having individual tutorials, and listening to lectures. These four activities are long-established features of our higher education, and they are almost as important now as they were 100 years ago. Now let's look at the features of them one by one. First, essay writing. The central focus of university work, especially in the humanities, for example, in literature, history, or politics, is on students producing regular essays and papers, which summarize and express their personal understanding of the topic. Then, what is good about essay writing? Firstly, writing essays forces you to select what you find interesting in books and journals, and to express your understanding in a coherent form. Individual written work also provides teachers with the best available guide to how you are progressing in the subject, and allows them to give advice on how to develop your strengths or counteract your weaknesses. Lastly, of course, individual written work is still the basis of almost all assessment in higher education. Written assignments familiarize you with the forms that your exams or coursework papers will take. The second key activity in colleges and universities is seminars and class discussions. Their role is to help you internalize academic knowledge by providing specialized contexts so that you can talk about such difficult problems as the trade-off between inflation and unemployment in economic policy, or the use of metaphors in Shakespeare's plays. Talking is a more interactive activity than written work. In the conversation, you know immediately how effectively you are expressing a viewpoint and can modify what you are saying in response to people's reactions. In addition, a normal program of between 10 and 25 classes will cover far more topics in one subject than you can hope to manage in your written work. Participating in flexible conversations across this range of issues also allows you to practice using the broad knowledge gained from other key activities as lecture. Now, let's take a look at another activity, individual tutorials. Discussions between a teacher and one or two students are used in many colleges as a substitute for or a supplement to group discussions in classes like those mentioned before. Tutorials can range from direct explanations by the teacher in the subject to flexible conversational sections which, at their best, are effective in stimulating students' mastery of the body of knowledge. One-to-one quality of the personal interaction is very important in stimulating acceptance of ideas and producing fruitful interaction. In order to make individual tutorials really work, students should make good preparation beforehand and during the tutorial. They should also ask questions to keep the ball rolling, rather than let teachers talk in a vacuum. The last activity is lectures. As we all know, lectures play a large part in most students' timetables and occupy a considerable proportion of teachers' efforts. However, the major difficulty with lectures is that they are not interactive like discussions or tutorials. The lecturer normally talks for the whole time with minimal feedback from questions. Besides, taking notes in lectures while concentrating on the argument being developed is often difficult to some students, especially when the argument is very complicated. However, having said that, lectures are clearly valuable in several specific ways. They can provide a useful overview, an area map, as it were, to familiarize you with the main landscape features to be encountered during a course. Lectures typically give much more accessible descriptions of theoretical perspectives in their oral presentations than can be found in the academic literature. Whenever there is a rapid pace of progress in theory or practice, lectures play an indispensable part in letting students know the development immediately, usually several years before the new material is included in textbooks. Lastly, lectures are often very useful in allowing you to see directly how exponents of different views build up their arguments. The cues provided by seeing someone talking in person may seem irrelevant, but these cues are important aids to understanding the subjects better later. So far, we've discussed four study activities and their respective features and roles in higher education. Of course, study activities are not limited to just these four types. There are other activities that are equally important, such as general reading, project learning, etc. We'll cover them during our next lecture. Now, you have 2 minutes to check your notes, and then please complete the 15-minute gap-filling task on the answer sheet. This is the end of listening comprehension.